go write him a text or lit him a
whatever gets you talking. Whatever gets you talking.
Good chat on the game, kick off your flip-flops. You can ask on your couch while you binge watch. However you do it, you gotta ask a friend. And if they don't share, you can ask again.
Whatever gets you talking. Whatever gets you talking.
Reach out to a friend about their mental health. Learn how you can help at seizetheawkward.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council, American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, and the Jed Foundation.
I always look forward to Rossano Radio on WMFO Medford 91.5 FM.
Bringing you the hottest tracks from around the globe.
I always look forward to Rossano Radio.
With your host, FR. Thursdays at 10 a.m.
Rossano Radio on WMFO Medford 91.5 FM and worldwide at WMFO.org.
Thursdays at 10 a.m.
Rossano Radio, only here on WMFO.
I'm interested in things. I'm not a real doctor, but I am a real worm.
Welcome back to the Shukri Wright Show on 91.5 FM WMFO in Medford, Tusk Free Firm Radio, streaming nationwide on the TuneIn Radio app and globally on WMFO.org, wherever you may be, however you may be listening. Welcome to hour number two of the Shukri Wright Show here at 91.5 FM WMFO in Medford, Tusk Free Firm Radio. I don't do this often anymore, but this particular guest that I have on now may be the reason why I return to doing live radio interviews here in the Shukri Wright Show, 91.5 FM WMFO in Medford. This man is a book writer, a terrific baseball writer himself, someone who reached out to me a couple of months ago to basically have him on my radio show or podcast, and my goodness, I do not regret having him on at all. In fact, I am honored to have this gentleman on. It is Kirk McKnight. He is the author of the new book, The Voices of Baseball. If you are a baseball fan and you love baseball broadcasters, this book is truly phenomenal in every right. And you're about to see exactly why, or hear exactly why. Kirk McKnight now joins the Shukri Wright Show on 91.5 FM WMFO in Medford. Good morning, Kirk. How are you doing today?
Good morning. I'm doing a lot better after that intro. Goodness, how could I not be?
I hope so, and please do know it's absolutely heartfelt, because I mean, like, I've always been one who, even now as a broadcaster myself, with be radio or even doing like play by play games or commentary on ESPN+, like it resonated with me with a lot of different reasons, because I grew up in New York, like loving baseball broadcasters. I grew up, you know, listening to the likes of John Sterling, Michael Kay, and as well as like listening to Met games when Gary Cohen and Harry Rose used to do radio together, and now Gary Cohen doing games on SNY on the TV side for the Mets. So I've always have had a very special affinity for baseball broadcasters, and in this book, The Voices of Baseball, I thought really touched on some of the most amazing stories from broadcasters themselves in relations to memorable moments, memorable games, historic moments in the history of baseball, and so forth. Kirk, tell the audience about the book and what inspired you to write the book, and what was the most enjoyable aspect of writing the book?
Well, the book is basically a collection of the most cherished and favorite memories of these broadcasters. And one way I like to look at it is you got pretty much about two millennia worth of broadcasting experience among these 50 broadcasters. So, you know, what I first tried to do going out in the first edition of it was kind of focus more on the ballparks and, you know, the uniqueness of each ballpark.
Yes.
The book does, regardless. But then you start to realize that you can't just confine it to these broadcasters' experiences in their own home ballparks. They call amazing and memorable games on the road as well. I mean, Pat Hughes from the Chicago Cubs called, you know, 2016 World Series Game 7. That was in Cleveland, you know, and that wasn't in Wrigley Field, and that was the first time the Cubs had won a World Series in 108 years. You're talking about somebody who's setting the precedent, you know, setting the precedent for broadcasting a World Series championship for a team that had been around forever, because the last time they had won it was way before radio broadcasting even happened. So it really became more expanded to just what's your favorite memory, period. You include people like Bob Costas in it, and Bob Costas is more of a national broadcaster.
Oh, absolutely.
And so, you know, you have to ask him, well, what's your most memorable game? Knowing that it could be any one of any ballpark, past or present, it just so happened to be a game that took place in Wrigley Field, the ballpark that's still standing. And we go from there.
There are a lot of memorable excerpts from the book that I want to touch on, like, as we move along in this conversation. But one of the most memorable ones for me that stood out, and I was reading the chapter up on Ken Korach, who was the radio voice of the Oakland A's, and there's a section that I remember coming across. It was from May 9th, 2010, a day that I remember quite well. It was Mother's Day, and it was a Sunday. And I remember tuning into Baseball Tonight to watch the highlights, and I had no idea as to what had happened, just happened moments before, because I fell asleep taking a nap. And it just so happened that Dallas Braden had thrown a perfect game. And King Korach, in that specific portion of that chapter, talked about his most memorable broadcast, in which he said, quote, "I can say that the most intense I think I've ever been, maybe in my stomach, was churning, and where there was the most drama in one single game was Dallas Braden's perfect game. When you're a broadcaster, you think you'll never have that opportunity because they're so infrequent. That was the 19th in history. In terms of storylines, in terms of the confluence of storylines, people always say Hollywood would never write a script like that. Nobody would believe it." Like, when you hear King Koretz say that, in terms of talking about the nerves of an announcer calling a perfect game, although themselves, they're not the ones throwing it, but you can, like, hear and sense the nerves. What goes through your mind as someone who's having a conversation, who has witnessed and broadcasted history, one of the most rare occurrences in all of sports?
I mean, the book is full of experiences like that, not necessarily all perfect games, but
yeah.
That was the whole point of the book, is you have this pool of like you said, when you have 2,000 years worth of broadcasting experience, you know you're bound to find a big collection of those, and you just want every single one of them. And thinking about, and there's also like a backstory to Dallas Braden that's included in the book because
yes.
of the way he grew up. And this happened on Mother's Day in front of his grandmother, who basically was his guardian for the better part of his life when he needed a guardian because his parents were in the picture. And so you hear a story like that, and you're just like, yeah, it's just like you said. It's this. If you're going to pitch this to a Hollywood producer, like, yeah, this could never happen. I had several instances in the book where they said that exact thing, where this is something that if you were to pitch it to a producer, they would just quickly just toss it aside because like this could never happen. that's why we have Hollywood. Well, we have Hollywood because Hollywood likes to basically, you know, re-portray and commemorate these moments. Dallas Braden's the perfect example of it. The Washington Nationals winning the 2019 World Series.
Yeah.
In spite of everything that could have gone wrong and had gone wrong all the previous years that they had gone to the playoffs, they all went right that year, and that led to them winning a Game 7 against a team that probably on paper was better than in the Houston Astros.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit younger, not more younger, that's not a word, but yeah, a little bit younger and just a little bit poised more and set the tone for that matchup. And then if we remember that World Series, not a single game was won by the home team. Never are you ever going to see that again.
Yeah. And that's what makes baseball so enjoyable, because you see things that happen that you're like, has that ever happened before? And that was a perfect example in which that prior to the 2019 World Series between the Nationals and the Astros, no team has ever won a World Series not winning a single game at home, and it happened. And as you put it succinctly, Kirk, I don't think it's ever going to happen again. And earlier in one of your responses, you were talking about the ballparks and like the broadcaster's perspective on like the ballparks. We know that like some of the great voices in the game, including especially being here in Boston, we're spoiled with the one and only Joe Castiglione, the radio voice of the Boston Red Sox since 1983, and he talked about that as well as Ken Howson, even when he was a player, like the experiences of being at Fenway Park, and I want to ask you, like, what did you learn from Joe, and as well as talking with Ken Harrelson about the uniqueness of Fenway Park and what makes that ballpark so special?
Well, obviously, any lay person is going to just, and that's kind of the joke, is that, you know, when I asked Joe, you know, the perfunctory question, you know, what makes this ballpark unique from every other, and he just says, the wall. as a journalist, you're, oh, okay, thank you. You know, I'm like, I'm talking to Joe Castiglione, can I get a little bit more? And then he laughs, of course, I don't have to even say anything, and then we go from there. Because that's the obvious answer right off the bat. That's, just, you know, maybe one of the most unique features in all of baseball is that green monster in Fenway. And not just for what it looks like, but, you know, a lot of people feel like the green monster is like this insurmountable foe. And it's not really, if you think about it. You know, those that would be on the warning track at most parks, these, you know, moon-raking pop-ups, over that monster, and Dorgan would be completely 10 or 12 rows up because their laser shot, you know, in any other ballpark, basically hits it up halfway up and ends up being like a loud thing. So, you know, you get that perspective when Joe and other broadcasters who have been there and seen it, and you just come to know it. And, of course, anybody in Boston is going to say, yeah. I mean, those, I think they call it like wall ball singles or something. Some areas of life, but you know, they're used to those things. And then, you know, somebody who may not really be as versed or not as familiar with Fenway may just think that the monster is like the hardest thing to overcome in all of baseball, and it's really not like that. You think of ballparks across the country that have 420-foot dead center, yep, you know, walls into deep center, like in Comerica, Detroit, and also just the high lifts in areas like San Francisco, where not only is the wind shooting around and possibly turning that into, you know, something that just stays in the park, same thing with Whitney, but it becomes a hard poke no matter what. And so you talk to these broadcasters about to realize the circumstances that, you know, Joe Schmo can hit a pop-up that's like, that just carries just enough, you know, that will just kind of trickle over that monster, and you're just like, oh, I guess it is gone. And then you see, like, somebody like Giancarlo Stanton can make a mouse out of a ball at points, and, you know, same thing with Gary Sanchez. But then you have these other guys who don't get enough lift and in a hurry, that just, you know, they shoot these laser shots and basically just makes a big fat dent in a big green wall.
For those of you that are just tuning in, Kirk McKnight, the author of the book, The Voices of Baseball, he's here with us on the Shukri Wright Show on 91.5 WMFO in Medford. Really a phenomenal book. And another part I would like to touch on was in Chapter 9, you had the opportunity to talk with John Miller, the Hall of Famer, the Hall of Fame broadcaster and voice of the San Francisco Giants on the radio side on KNBR, and as well as you talked with Gary Thorne as well. But as a baseball historian like myself, I am always fascinated by when baseball has these moments where it transcends the sport. And I think none more than that could have been true than the night of September 6, 1995. And you asked John Miller about What was that moment like, and that evening like, especially when he was talking with President Clinton. And there's an excerpt in this chapter that that really stood out. And I just want to go read it just real quick. You wrote, quote, Miller describes his presidential encounter behind the microphone. I remember President Clinton coming on the air with me in the fourth inning, and Cal came up while the president was on and went to three balls and no strikes. The pitch came in and boom, he hit it. He hit it a long way, and I knew it was going to be a home run in the moment he hit it. I started getting real excited with my call, but the president had his own microphone and he shouted me down. He's like, go, go, yes, ha ha. And he started clapping and laughing. I remember hearing the highlight afterwards, and I was just sort of this disembodied voice. I sounded like I was in the back of the booth. I thought it was so hilarious because we sometimes we hear broadcasters saying, I don't like being like talked over my call. And as you're having this conversation with John Miller, like, tell me about what the things that he was experiencing. Obviously that night, obviously we all know that was the night that that Cal Ripken set the new Iron Man record, but as well as being in the booth with the President of the United States at that time.
John Miller being in this book is maybe the perfect definition of just manna when it comes to a book of this nature, because I was, when I interviewed John, that was early in the interviewing process, and it was for the San Francisco chapter. And that, to me, was already one of these surreal experiences. Later on, when I'm trying to get a couple of quotes about Scully, this was back in 2014, basically the only chapter left to cover was the Baltimore chapter in Camden Yards. And when you're writing a book about ballparks, I mean, to basically not give the importance of Camden Yards and what a revolutionary addition it was to the game, and is to the game of baseball. Yeah, you basically wanted to be the best you could make it, because this is really the focus of your book. And John said, well, I mean, I broadcast for the Orioles for X amount of years. I could help you. And I'm like, oh, my gosh. So I'm going to get John Miller to be in two chapters. And when you think about everything surrounding that chapter about the ballpark, now, the Cal Ripken story in and of itself, in any city like Cincinnati, Cleveland, or even Oakland, even the Oakland Coliseum, that story in and of itself is amazing. Just basically breaking the record that maybe nobody thought was ever going to be broken. Because in this day and age, you just see people get too injured. You see coaches that, or managers bench their players just to give them a little rest. So, you know, a record like this, you just don't think it's going to happen. So not only is this record taking place, but it is taking place in a ballpark that accentuated the moment. That warehouse over the right field wall leading up to the day where he actually broke the record, you have to understand that there's also baseball rules. It wasn't as simple as Cal walking onto the field, taking his position in the infield, and there's the record. It actually had to become an official game.
Yeah.
And so John Miller's walking through it, and basically in those days leading up to it, to basically be able to illustrate what the rule was. You have a guy named Charles Steinberg who is running the audiovisual and everything like that, scoreboard at the ballpark, and he's basically putting on the scoreboard, basically going into the bottom of the fifth inning. The rule says, you know, if you're the home team and you're leading going into the fifth inning, the game is official. Or if you're, you know, if you're trailing and you complete the fifth inning, the game is official. And play the music, and then you look out to the right field and you see them drop the, you know, the next number down, and now it's at 2,100 and so on, and then, you know, the next day it's the next one. And, you know, people at first were just kind of like, what are we doing here? Like, what is this pageantry? But then they realized that it was important for their fans to be educated on that.
Yeah.
So that when the moment actually happened, and in that game, you know, the going into the bottom of the fifth, now we know this game's official. Now we know the record is his. And now we have this half-hour celebration of just any possible. I mean, it, like you said, it's a moment that transcends baseball. And I can't think of anybody even trying to cut it short. And the only person probably who tried to cut it short was Cal himself, because he was running a fever. And he was like, I seriously am going to collapse if you guys try to make me run wrong. It's like, I am going to collapse. And what irony would that be? But they celebrate him breaking the Iron Man record and him falling down on the field and not being able to make the try. I mean, how tragic would that be?
Wow. No, go ahead. I'm just like, just amazed. This is an amazing story. Please continue.
And John Miller, with his infinite memory that he has, is telling that story also earlier in the game when, you know, the game wasn't official at the time. I don't believe the game was official when Cal hit that home run. So we're all, like, still anticipating the moment. And then I think he hits that home run. And then, of course, we have the pageantry. But, you know, being in the sitting booth as the President of the United States, you think about all the moments that John Mueller has been able to collect now, you know, we're talking 2023 and broadcast three championships for the Giants, two championships for the A's, and a championship for the Orioles. You really have a pretty blessed career. So if you're basically going to be out-touted in one play that you wanted to call, and it's by the President of the United States, John Mueller totally acknowledged, hey, if this is the way it was supposed to be, the President of the United States, the Commander-in-Chief cheering on Cal right here on the radio wave.
Truly, absolutely amazing. For those of you that are just tuning in, having here with me on the show, on the Shukrat Show, 91.5 FM, WMFO, is Kirk McKnight. He is the author of the book, The Voices of Baseball. Truly a phenomenal read. And I can't, if I attempted to fawn over the book any more than what I have, I don't think I could succeed, Kirk. And I say that like wholeheartedly, but on a little bit more of a sentimental side of things, there was a chapter that really touched, that made me a little emotional, if you will. It was the chapter in which that you had the privilege of interviewing, this is in chapter 13, Dave Wills, the late Dave Wills, who just passed away, sadly, a month and a half ago, Andy Freed and Charlie Slows. And it was specifically that chapter that made me emotional, obviously, because like Dave Wills just sadly just passed away in his sleep during spring training a month or so ago, and I want to give you the opportunity to like to share with me your reflections and memories and having the opportunity to speak with Dave and obviously like what he meant to baseball broadcasters and as well as like to the Tampa Bay community.
Well, Dave Wills said something in our interview back in 2014 when I first interviewed him, and he said, what I did beats working for a living. And that became a mantra for me. I thought, you know what, I wish that I could basically say that. You know, here I was at the time working full-time as a valet on the Las Vegas Strip in a job that I neither loved nor hated too bad, but like if we're leaning on the spectrum is more towards hated. And just having somebody like Dave Wills say, what I do beats working for a living, after basically a half an hour of conversation with him where he shares just how much he just loves what he does. And so, yes, when he passed away, it really hit me hard because, you know, Tim McCarver passed away as well.
Yes.
A few weeks before that. But my conversation with Tim was, you know, it was a 15-minute conversation, and I could tell on the other end of the phone that I was talking with somebody who was dying. And I didn't know that, and the public didn't know that, but I could tell that I was talking with somebody whose light was growing dimmer, and it was a sad, it's sad to think back on it now, and I'm grateful that I was able to catch Dave Wills in this time where we are talking about his favorite moment, and catching up with Andy Freed for the updated edition and his contribution to the Tampa Bay chapter, as well as Charlie Slows kind of setting the tone by showing how the team actually came into effect, and some of the things that even happened that didn't happen also that affected Tampa Bay, like the Giants almost moving to Tampa Bay in 1992. So when you think of the Tampa Bay chapter and you think of, okay, they haven't ever won a World Series, but they've been to two, you know, their history is not as enriched as to say the Red Sox or the Yankees or the Dodgers or a handful of other teams. But also, they play in a ballpark that most people who ever been there are like, this is crap. Why is a team like this playing in a crap ballpark like this? And in spite of all that, you have these guys who just love what they do. And they're a great fandom. And I can't imagine how much Andy Freed's heart is just broken by the passing of Dave, because those two were like just a great on-screen duo, if you will, both on the radio waves. And
basically, that is a perfect example of why I feel this book should go to be in every room of every baseball fan across the country, because it doesn't matter who you're a fan of, you can pick up this book and your team is well represented and some of your favorite moments are right there. But then you can also flip to another random chapter and find out just how much baseball means to these guys and how much fun they have doing their job, win or lose. And that's one thing about Dave and Andy, talking with Andy about the 2020 World Series. Yes, they lost in six games against a very dominant Dodger team, a team that overmatched them practically across the board, but they still had an amazing time. They still had some of the plays that they'll never forget, like the conclusion of Game 4. If anybody's ever... It's so intricate, the last play of Game 3 of the 2020 World Series, and the way Andy Reid explains it, he says, you got the best team in baseball looking like the Bad News Bears. And that's exactly what it was if you watch that play. And I want to call it a walk-off, but I think walk-off doesn't do it justice.
No, not at all.
It's just like, I think it's somersault, turn to and fall upon is really what it was. And that's how the guy got to the plate to win the game. And you have these guys who just love what they do. And, yeah, the amazing effort in the 2020 World Series was something that they'll always cherish and be forever grateful for. And, you know, to think about that, and it took place maybe a little over 2 years before his passing, you can see that Dave Will still goes, you know, to the grave with that cherished memory. And you just sit there and you feel, that's awesome. That's great for him. At least he had that, as many as the others that he had.
And that was really, that was truly beautiful, a beautiful reflection and dedication to the late Dave Wells. And you also mentioned about having an opportunity to talk to Tim McCarver in his final days. As many of you know, Tim McCarver, the Hall of Fame broadcaster himself, longtime announcer on MLB on Fox, passed away back in February as well. And there was a chapter, it was chapter 14, in which that you had the privilege of talking to Greg Schulte, who was going to be retiring at the end of the season after 25 years, and it seemed like forever that he was the radio voice of the Arizona Diamondbacks. And there was a section in that chapter in which I'll just mention the date, and you'll know exactly what I'm talking about for the baseball fans that are listening. November 4th, 2001. If you know that date and the significance of that date in baseball history, do you know what I'm talking about? It was Game 7 of the 2001 World Series. It was the first time that the World Series was played in the month of November because of the tragic events of 9/11. And Tim McCarver had one of the most memorable calls, in my opinion, in his career. And I would love to get your thoughts on this, Kirk, as well, in which that he foreshadowed, I don't know how, but he foreshadowed what was going to happen when Luis Gonzalez was in the midst of his at-bat against future Hall of Fame closer Mariano Rivera of the New York Yankees. And I just want to get your thoughts, and as well as your recollection on that conversation with Tim McCarver on that particular moment that is one of the few times that a walk-off hit has won a World Series for a team in baseball history.
So the beautiful thing about moments like that is that there are no less than a handful of accounts of it across the board, whether it be the visiting or the home broadcast, or whether it be the sports writers who are there capture the moment, or people who just chronicle it after the fact. They tell the tale, and they basically paint the picture in a way that really just, you know, they can only hope justifies and dignifies the moment. And then you talk to the person who called it, knowing that there is all this, you know, all this recollection of it and all this ode to it, if you will, and a celebration of it. And you ask them personally about it, and you get Tim McCarver saying, Well, it's what I'm paid to do. You know? And that's as beautiful as they get, because I laughed when he said it. I was like, no, I'm serious. You know, because he's like, you know, and of course he really was, you know, being kind of light about it. And you have somebody who, I'm not sure how many people realize just how smart and intuitive Ben McCarver is. I hope that any former player turned broadcaster just watches footage of him on Fox or any other place, or the, you know, when he broadcasts for the Cardinals, mm-hmm. and just realizes what an acumen he has. And he knows, and in that actual chapter, in that sense, you know, he points out somebody like David Cohen, who he says is an excellent broadcaster. We also know David Cohen is somebody who has been around the block in a uniform as well. So yeah. You have people who have this experience as players, who have the knowledge of the game. And, you know, Joe Buck is on the call. He's got the call. And Tim, as you know, as basically the, you know, the color commentary, just offers that up about playing the infield in too short on somebody like Rivera, who pitches in on the hitters, and it creates these bloop, you know, these bloop short kind of pop ups into the infield, and it causes trouble. And sure as snow is on the mountain in Kilimanjaro or wherever at that moment. You know, sure as that, that's exactly what happened. And Joe, you know, if you read Joe's book on his biography, he's making the call.
Yeah.
And he's high-fiving Tim McCarver at the same time, because Tim nailed it. Right there, he nailed it. And those are the poignant moments that make a broadcaster's career, that people look back and say, wow. You know, that was a great addition to the book, for the updated edition, because talking with Greg Schulte about that night, he brought so much insight to all the things that led up to the hit, and a lot of things that when you're all caught up in the moment and the walk off and the single and everything like that, you mm-hmm. think about the things that could have changed, and one of them being, when nobody talks about it, the other being when the runner on first and second and they bunted, Rivera rifled it over to Scott Brosius at the third, and Brosius just put it in his pocket, just recorded the put out, and that was it. But Brosius, if Brosius really would have made an effort, he could have run across the first and maybe got the runner by a step. But, you know, and nobody really talks about that. And think about that. Now, you know, what if you had a runner on second, two outs, as opposed to a runner on first and second, one out? What could have been the outcome there? And so, you know, broadcasters that recognize that. And maybe Scott Brosius, you know, 22 years later, thinks to himself, why did I not just throw it across the mound? Because, you know, what's the worst that happens? You know, you miss your throw, or the guy just beats it out, and basically it's a fielder's choice. There could have been a crazy double play put out there and a completely different set of circumstances for Rivera to work with and probably win the game in that sense. But, you know, that's the thing that broadcasters do. It's just like Tim said, that's what we're paid to do. So when you think of that moment and what a historic moment, I live in Arizona, and so it's, you know, it's 22 years later, and they haven't had anything that even comes close to that kind of moment as far as the postseason. So these are the things that are just draped along the walls in the press booths and the press area and the press level and the concourses as well. And it's something they can forever be grateful for. And McCarver, though he's not a broadcaster for the Arizona Diamondbacks, maybe one of the most memorable calls that Diamondbacks, especially the TV viewers tuning on the World Series, will always remember that.
And certainly that is one of the most memorable moments in World Series history, no question about that. And I have a couple of more questions left for you before we wrap up the radio interview. One of them in which that you had the privilege of talking with Howie Rose and Wayne Hagen, that's in chapter 26, as someone who grew up in New York, and there's always been this dynamic of the Yankees are up here and the Mets are the perpetual stepbrother, if you will. And the thing that stood out to me about this particular chapter, I thought that you really like encapsulated like two different eras of Mets baseball well. You did the Shea Stadium era, and as well as you also had the chance to like, you know, go into like the Citi Field era of the New York Mets where they have called home since 2009. And the aspect of it that really caught my eye was where you talked about ballparks and you talked about like features of ballparks. Once upon a time, Shea Stadium, and more people would probably agree or disagree to this point I'm about to make, Shea Stadium was, I think, neutral. It was neither a pitcher's ballpark or a home run's ballpark. Citi Field, when it was opened in 2009, no one expected that Citi Field would become the graveyard for home run hitters. No one could have foreseen it. And I thought that in the section of the chapter that you covered that well was where you titled Rest in Peace Home Run Ball. And I laughed so hard because I said, this is so accurate. Tell the listeners about how in the world that Citi Field became this graveyard of a ballpark for home runs when it first opened the first couple of years, beginning in 2009, up until then we started moving in the fences and so forth in later years.
I mean, nothing is going to tell the story more than your most cherished and probably favorite player offensively completely switched statistically. And that's the case with Citi Field when you have David Wright, who at the time when Citi Field was opening, all the Mets, you know, he was all the craze. This was before people like Pete Alonso, before getting Francisco Lindor over there. And forgive me for any Mets that I'm not, you know, that I'm neglecting to mention here, but David Wright was the guy. And David Wright's offensive numbers were great at Shea. And now you have this ballpark that isn't so kind to a player like David Wright. And you know, injuries as well, and kind of David Wright kind of fades away into the limelight. And that is the unfortunate thing that happens in this transition. Another example of that is Joe Mauer going from the, you know, Metrodome, to Target Field. His numbers dropped. And, you know, Joe Mauer, I don't know if he's been retired long enough to be considered for the Hall of Fame or not, but I guarantee that guy's going to the Hall of Fame. You can't have the numbers that guy has.
Yeah.
But there's another example. Look at how he just was affected by it, and that's a perfect example. And so you can point to we're across the parking lot from where we've been for decades, yet now we're in a completely new atmosphere. Now we're in a completely new set of dimensions and just all these things that come into play. And it's like, you know, they always say about football being a life is a football is a game of inches. Well, baseball is too. Just look at the spin on the ball where the ball hits the bat. When you take into account putting the fences out where they did and just any other number of factors, it turns a hitter-friendly Shea Stadium into a pitcher-friendly Citi Field really quick in terms of tables. So that's what has happened in a few of these ballparks. You're going to see Jacob DeGrom, even though he came from a pretty pitcher-friendly ballpark in Citi Field, now he's over in Globe Life Field, it is a pitcher-friendly field as well. People just automatically assume now that they're in Texas that the ball is going to fly out of there. No, now they're indoors in Texas. Indoors in Texas on a summer's evening is a whole lot different than outdoor in Texas on a summer's evening, especially for a pitcher and especially for the configuration of the ballpark. So, I didn't relegate this just to Citi Field, but I'm just trying to say how these tiny little factors do have an overall effect on the game.
And definitely, there was none more exemplified than Citi Field, the first few years of existence. And the thing that I found amazing about it is, I thought the lessons from Citi Field, like, definitely translated to, in my opinion, to like the other ballparks that opened up, like, in recent memory, most notably, the ballpark for the Texas Rangers. I thought that, like, Globe Life Park specifically. Whereas when they built that ballpark, I thought, wow, like, is it home run friendly? Yes, but I think it gives you a fair advantage. Whereas Citi Field, when it was first built, and especially like pre-renovation, like, in terms of moving the fences in and everything else, was like, you were a homer hitter at Shea Stadium? Nah, now you're a doubles hitter at best. And it's like, and I think there's one player in my mind that could not have been more true or applied to better than Jason Bay. You think of Jason Bay before he got to the Mets. He was a home run hitter. He had good gap-to-gap power. He gets to Citi Field, and nothing's leaving. And you're thinking, what's wrong with him physically? Like, no, look at the ballpark where he plays. Look at the dimensions. It's literally a graveyard.
I mean, Robinson Cano is another perfect example. Robinson Cano flourishing in Yankee Stadium. You take him to what is now called T-Mobile Park, but when he played there was Safeco Field over in Seattle. And that's a very pitcher-friendly park as well as Citi Field. And where's Robinson Cano? How much expectation did we have of Cano leaving the friendly confines of Yankee Stadium, one of the hitter-friendliest ballparks in baseball? And there you go right there. The numbers die. You could probably throw other factors into it, but that one stands up as far as consistency when it comes to inconsistency in Cano's regard.
Absolutely. And final question. You in Chapter 27, you had the privilege of interviewing John Sterling, Michael Kay, and Bob Costas at Yankee Stadium, specifically for the New York Yankees chapter. And you talked about Yankee Stadium. And someone who I grew up going to games at old Yankee Stadium and have gone to games at new Yankee Stadium, it just brought back a lot of memories of, like, what the old Yankee Stadium meant to baseball, and as well as, like, the history that was at the old venerable cathedral of baseball, if you will, versus, like, the new ballpark where it's got all the amenities, is much more spacious, but yet it still has this grand feel, which you put really, like, succinctly. In fact, there is a quote that stood out to me in that regard, in which that John Sterling, the radio voice, the longtime radio voice of the New York Yankees since 1989, he said, quote, in this chapter, "You see this unbelievably magnificent, majestic ballpark. It's enormous. They have so many levels of seats and so much advertising. It's such a great sight. It's great for the fans. It looks like old Yankee Stadium, but it's bigger and more modern. The odd thing about the space is the ballpark takes up it's enormous, yet it seats only 48,000 because they have bigger seats, wider rows, and bigger concourses." So when you had the opportunity to talk with John Sterling about new Yankee Stadium, and as well as like old Yankee Stadium, as you did in the chapter, what were some of the things that really stood out to you in regards to speaking with John Sterling, but as well as Michael Kay, who broadcast alongside John Sterling for 10 years on the radio side of the booth during the Yankee dynasty?
Well, to me, talking with John Sterling, having listened to him so many times, following the Yankees for years myself, and also following the Braves as a youth, because before he was with the Yankees, he was with the Braves.
Yes.
Considered himself the junior member of the firm, which how he described himself, his role as the Braves, for the years he was in Atlanta. So we're talking about a person who I've had a familiarity with all along the way. And so now I'm talking to him in person. And of course, like, now I'm in my little freak out, geek out mode. And trying to get a question out. Of course, I obviously calmed myself down before the interview and did it. But you're talking to somebody who is, after years of futility in Atlanta, and the first few years of futility in, you know, coming over in 89, so suffering through the few years where the Yankees were just terrible. You're talking a person who got called five championships over a relatively short period of time, four championships in 5 years. And you're talking to somebody who just, it's like, oh, you want a memory? You got one. Here we go. You know, and he's got them. And it's the Yankees around them, you know, the Yankees during that late 90s run where they won 96, 98, 99, 2000. You know, got people like Joe Buck who memorized old Yankee Stadium. Basically could walk blindfold to the broadcast booth because he did it so many times as a, you know, broadcaster for Fox in the World Series.
Mm-hmm.
And that right there should tell the story of just, as you know, an over, you know, overall big, broad brushstroke of what it is to pull Yankee games as somebody for 162 games like Sterling. And they were 162 games because Mike Sterling was basically the broadcasting Iron Man for the longest time until I think he was finally, like, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, finally,
yeah.
He kind of took a minute, you know, but you can count on John being on the broadcast. It's, you know, if the sun rose that day, even if the sun was behind the clouds, John was broadcasting. So talking to him and being, you know, he was spoiled. I mean, you ask him his favorite memories from Yankee Stadium, and he looks at you like, are you kidding me? Like, how much time do you have? I don't have that time. you know, it's not in being crushed. It's basically a testament to how blessed the school has been from the 95 season, even though they lost the Mariners, but the 95 season up till today. And even when they're not winning World Series championships, they're still the talk of all of baseball in some aspect. Last year with Judge chasing Maris, you got a Yankee chasing a Yankee. Hey, deja vu. We had a Yankee chasing a Yankee in 61. So how great is that for the sport when you're basically chasing a record set by the team whose, you know, uniform has, you know, been worn by some of the greatest who ever lived a century before, and you've got Aaron Judge towing the line and following the same path that Maris did in 61, where he himself was chasing a Yankees legend. And, you know, though Maris is not a winner as far as Yankee, you know, gloriousness in the, you know, he's not in that upper echelon with the other names, he is still somebody who had a record that nobody thought was going to be broken. And the legitimacy, I mean, I'm going to open up the door on that one as far as, you know, McGuire and Bonds and Sosa, but you had somebody who was in a Yankees uniform facing a Yankee record, and yes, they got swept by the Astros in the LCS, but I mean, do we really remember that so much as we remember that chase? And that's the beautiful thing about baseball is everybody in the country was tuned to Michael Kay and Paul O'Neill and sorry, David Cohn at any point during September, because we're tuning in. Oh, we're winning, you know. I mean, how many times did Michael Kay say, oh, we're not going to go back to tuning in. Basically just saying, like, ESPN. I mean, he had to do it every time because it was like, what am I calling? What are you doing YES right now? But we got ESPN all across the country in too, so I'll give them a little shout-out. I mean, he had to do it every freaking at-bat for Judge, but I think I just went completely down the rabbit hole on this answer, but I guess it just goes to show that no matter who's behind the mic at Yankee Stadium, there's history happening. They would like it to be more repetitive as far as the World Series championships were again, but they still love their guys like Kay and Sterling for their calls. Like the other day, I was at my daughter in the car, and I said, all right, listen, here's what he's going to say, because I knew a home run was happening, and I was going to say, it is high, it is far, it is, yeah! and I'm like, and if you were tuning in on the TV, it was just, if you were tuning in on the TV, you would have been like this. Oh, we know these calls, and they've had so many of them, but we still love them. We still look forward to that. We still will lip sync it as it's happening because we just know these broadcasters so well. So what a gift to baseball the Yankees are, as much as you want to hate them, because of broadcasters like Kay and Sterling. What a gift they are to baseball for those kinds of call signs.
It's been an absolute pleasure, man, to have you on the Sugar Ride Show here at 91.5 FM WMFO in Medford. That is Kirk McKnight. He is the author of the book, The Voices of Baseball. I strongly urge every single baseball fan to go out there, get the book, and read it wherever you can, and add it to your bookshelf. Read it at your time. It's so worth the read, and I hope that this interview gave you, the listener, and as well as you yourself, Kirk, the feeling like, listen, this is really a phenomenal book, full of great stories, as I try to encapsulate it as much as I possibly can during this interview, and I hope I did it justice.
You did. I appreciate the time, and I think I might just go buy myself a copy of the book and read it again.
Like it's so worth the read. Like it really is. And again, I really can't thank you enough for taking the time this morning to speak with me and to share with me your stories, and as well as just being able to just explore the different excerpts that I was able to pluck out from the book and be able to discuss it ad nauseum with you. So I appreciate your time, and as well as all that you do. Thank you so much, Kirk. I hope that you continue to do great work out there, and as well as enjoy the rest of this magnificent baseball season so far.
It has been a great season, and I thank you for your time. And I do look forward to a lot of things that we're seeing, and Pittsburgh being in the position they're in, that's good for baseball. Even however long it lasts, it's good for baseball. So people are tuned in wondering why their teams are in the third place when they should be in first. And definitely anybody in the NL Central looking up to Pittsburgh is wondering what happened and how many Make-A-Wish Foundation wishes were granted for this to happen. But you know what? Enjoy it while it lasts there.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Kirk. We'll talk again very soon.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. That was Kirk McKnight, the author of the book, The Voices of Baseball, on the Sugar Ray Show, 91.5 FM WMFO in Medford. Coming up next, it is going to be a brand new show, and it is the one and only Dance Express. And as my good friend is sitting over here silently waiting, I mean, I hope you enjoyed the interview as much as I did, because I thought it was really just spectacular. It was spectacular. Hold one second.
You did a great job. Nice job in the interview. You know, outstanding. And I was just going to tell you, if you needed to stretch on, you know, you could have went into my time. That would have been okay by me.
I appreciate the gesture, but it was it was more of like I wanted to give you the opportunity to do your show in full, and it was just really just phenomenal. I know, like, you're not the big like sports person, but for anyone who appreciates baseball, even as a casual fan, and loves listening to broadcasts on radio, because baseball is the perfect sport to listen to on radio, this is the book to read. Like, I mean, it's expansive. It's a lot of information and different stories, and not just only about the historical moments, but the finer details of like the ballparks and like things like that. It's just spectacular. Just really a spectacular read. What do you got planned for your show for today?
Well, I'm gonna start off, I think, with a little hip hop. I think we're gonna start. I'm gonna have you start the show as I usually do.
Oh man!
And I gotta tell you, we got a big event coming up on May 20th, and I'm hoping that maybe you can come up. We're in Hampton Field at the Hampton Airport, and we're doing a fundraiser for cystic fibrosis.
Oh wow!
Yeah, it's gonna be. My girl Lil and I are gonna be doing this, and we're talking, I don't know, 5,000-10,000 people.
Wow.
Yes, you got to come. I actually posted it out in the hallway.
I will do what I can to try to make it, but right. that sounds really phenomenal, like, seriously.
It'd be good.
Absolutely. In fact, where is the paper for the PSA? I think I may have forgotten to read it.
I can cover you on the next one if you want me to, unless you want to bang one quick out.
I won't mind banging it out, because I know, isn't there the donation drive one as well?
Oh, that's right.
That one.
That's up there, isn't it?
Yeah, the donations PSA. I don't see, is that the book right there?
Yeah, here's the book, but you know, if you look in the, on the Rivendell. you know, on the it might be posted on the
I don't see it. Wait, right. I don't see it. But nonetheless, it's been a blast to be here with you on the Sugar Rush Show, 91.5 FM WMFO.